Hello. Today is Monday, August the 9th, 1993. My name's Earl Chess. I'm an alcoholic. I invite you to listen to an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Fox Hall Group in Washington, D.C. Thank you, and I hope you like this tape.
I'd like to say this, that we don't want anybody sitting up on the stage, with the exception of this gentleman who's got a bad leg, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Okay, as I said, I'm George Strainer, and I'm an alcoholic. And what I would like to say this, because in introducing this particular man, I've heard Clancy probably seven or eight times, and I've introduced him every other time except one that I've heard him. I want to talk about my definition of sobriety. My definition of sobriety was the ability to learn how to live comfortably, and I like to put the word comfortably in quotes, with myself, the God of my understanding, and the rest of the world, one day at a time without the use of alcohol or any other mood-changing drug. Now, I am also a power freak. I want to tell everybody how they should do it, what they should do, and in control. But what AA has told me was to pass the message. Don't carry the drunk, carry the message. Well, Hal has told me, Clancy didn't tell me this, but Hal did, that Clancy was in South Africa for 10 days during June, and he was in Australia for 10 days in, South Africa in May and in Australia in June, passing the message. I know he's also been over in Europe. He travels throughout the country. This particular reason he's over here now is he was at the banquet in Richmond on Saturday night. I don't know whether it was Northern Virginia or the Virginia AA banquet, but anyway, he was in Richmond on Saturday night. And any time he comes here, I consider it a pleasure to always have Clancy come here to Foxhall and speak before us. And this is a typical AA meeting. I will tell you this, try to identify in. If you're a newcomer, look for the similar things. Do not try to compare out. They told me when I came in that if I got here, I was probably 3 years too late. They were right. I got sober in 1971. I had an opportunity in 1968. I didn't do it. And you don't have to go downhill. I was at a meeting this morning. Everybody was talking about bottoms. And I asked my sponsor one time, what was a high bottom drunk? And his answer was a guy who hasn't run out of money yet. Anyway, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Clancy I. I am very sorry, and I know I'm going to hear it. I forgot, will you please pass the baskets back?
It's Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. My job is to amuse you while they pass the basket. Then he's going to come back and make some more announcements. Tell you, Earl, I think you turned on the tape a little early. I've spoken many, many times in my life, but he's introduced me every time. He follows me around, and it's a pleasure to do this. But I'm glad to be here, glad to be at Fox Hall. I was talking the other day I don't know if you guys know this or not, but the biggest meeting in the Midwest is called the Fox Hall Group. And it's in Omaha. And the reason it's called the Fox Hall Group is because a guy named Dick Martin, who started the Fox Hall Group in Washington, later moved to Omaha and started the Fox Hall Group there. So the Fox Hall Group flourishes in Omaha and in Georgetown. I'm glad to be back here. I like to come to Washington. I'm not really coming to Washington to speak. That's not the great thing. I have a guy, a sponsor, who's here from Australia, and I'm showing him he's always wanted to see Washington, and I've showed him where Stonewall Jackson died. That's really a highlight of his trip. Stonewall, ew. Ah, shut up. Get the car. And I want to thank my friend Larry for buying dinner tonight with an old Exxon card. Glad to see Tom. A lot of people I'm glad. I want to thank Ed for buying me dinner last night, and I'm taking reservations for tomorrow night, if you'll just... But I used to drink alcohol, like most of you, I suppose, And I drank it for a long time, and unlike many people, I never paid much attention to drinking. I hear people sometimes talk as though they are obsessed with drinking. And then I had to move to a place where the liquor store was nearby, and I had to make sure my supply was there. I never thought of it much at all. Drinking was just something that I learned about when I was in my teens, and it always made me feel significantly better, and I used it as much as I could. And I didn't think anything about it. Or I didn't. I was drunk or in trouble. But I never really, you know, drinking. Alcohol was just a, as I've said many times, alcohol is the best friend I've ever had. That sounds terrible at an AA meeting, I'm sure, to new people. But I've never had a friend better than alcohol. I've never had a friend that made me feel better every time I was with him. I may not have had a friend who ever made me feel better at any time, now that I think about it. But I never had a job that made me feel good every time I went there. I never had a lover that made me feel wonderful every time I was with her. But every time I had a few drinks, it made me feel significantly better. I discovered that when I was a boy on the deck of a ship in Pearl Harbor, early in the Second World War. And I'd grown up in this very strict religious community in Wisconsin. I never had any whiskey. I was 15 years old, and they intimidated me into drinking some whiskey. So I did, and I threw it up, and they laughed at me. But I eventually held a drink down. I hated it. It was tiny, and my pimples stuck up, and all of a sudden, I felt significantly better. And that's how I remember that experience, and it always did that. You know, there's a book out that says, everything I need to know I learned in kindergarten. That's a bunch of nonsense. I never learned anything in kindergarten. I was a problem in kindergarten. You learn about life in your teens. That's when you learn about life. You learn about when your body changes. You learn about lust. And you learn about love. And you learn if you're going to have any luck whatsoever, you better learn to disguise lust as love. You learn about smoking. I learned to smoke on that ship. I hated smokers. But those men smoked, so I smoked. And I got sick until I finally could smoke, and I smoked two or three packs a day for the next 42 years. I learned a lot of things in my teens. And drinking was just something I learned about. And later on, I was in the merchant marine then, because I was too young to go in the Navy. I'd run away from home. But later in the war, I went in the Navy, and after the war, I took some tests, so I was able to not go back and go to high school anymore, and I went to college at the University of Wisconsin. And I got married in college, and out in the world, I became a sports writer. And I had made a kind of a mistake. Not a mistake, it's all right. I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Most of you never heard of that. Some of you have. But it's a very strict church. And it's a good church. My grandparents were big in the church. My parents were big. I was big in the church when I was little. I could sing in Norwegian, and they only really had two major rules in the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Wisconsin. You don't ever sin, and you don't ever monkey around with Catholics. Which seemed like reasonable rules. But as I was growing up, I noticed I need more fun than other Lutherans for some reason or other. I had stirrings, I guess. As I used to confess, I don't anymore, but I used to confess, you know, in that ship in Pearl Harbor, one thing that appalled me were these guys talking about the affairs they'd had while the ship had been in San Francisco. And I never heard talk like that. I was just, Now, even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex, but I'd been very apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And I didn't know these pictures came to life in San Francisco, I'll tell you that. But I was able to go to college after the war. And what I did in college, I met this girl with black hair. And in the Lutheran church, you never see girls like that. So they all got blonde hair or brown hair at the worst if they're from a mixed marriage. And someone with black hair just looks exotic. So I married her despite the fact she was a Catholic. Because I had become a sinner, and then I'd become monking with Catholics. And I'd got sinning with Catholics before that, so I was... And we started having... She She introduced me to a phenomenon I wasn't aware of, and that is this, that you, if you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to have a big family. And nobody really cares if you're prepared for it. And I used to plead to her, I said, can't we use birth control? And she said, no. I've thought about that many times since, you know, I thought to myself, to you young people, it seems very strange now, but in the 1940s, it took somebody with some kind of cojones to go in and order birth control devices. I couldn't do it. I was a wild guy, and I couldn't do it. We'd hire guys who had really guts. They'd go and say, hey, give me some cigarettes.
And some condoms.
You know, and we thought they were macho, boy. Now in the drugstore by my house, these little pukes come in and say things like, hey, give me some condoms.
And some cigarettes.
Yeah. I guess that's progress. But we started having children, and so I had to get better jobs. I got in advertising and public relations, did a lot of things over the years, had some degree of success. But the one thing that stayed with me most of my life, the thing that I discovered as I grew older, was that I seemed to have terribly intense and painful emotions that apparently other people didn't seem to have as well as I could tell by looking at them. Over the years, I've talked a lot about my emotions. Lately, I've been kind of putting in maybe three little areas. Probably one of the great emotions of my life, one that I could not identify when it was happening to me. That, you know, when you're new, you'll hear all these speakers, and they talk about, and then I realized, and then I realized, as though we knew it, but we didn't. We just bumbled through and then looked at it in retrospect, and, oh, yes, that's what it was. Yes, I see that now. And one of the great feelings of my life is that a feeling I could not identify when I had it, but I can, in looking back, I've always felt it, that in some way that I cannot understand, people see that there's something missing in me, and I don't know what it is. And they don't, nobody acts like they're putting me down, but it's just as though they don't seem to like me as well as they like other people. Other people seem to like each other instinctively more than they like me. People act as though there's something missing in me, but nobody ever tells me what it is. And I know if I get close to someone, they won't like me. So years ago, I guess, and without even being aware of it, I set up some defense mechanisms that I wasn't even aware of, where I got glib and full of one-liners and cute and clever and did my little dance to keep people at a distance, because then they'd like me. Because when they got close, they wouldn't like me anymore. So just be cute and clever. You're never any close to anybody, but you never get rejected. Another feeling I had much of my life is I always seem to feel one degree of fear or another. Some kind of, I suppose it's kind of a fear of when I'm being phony, I'm going to be found out that I'm not clever like I'm pretending to be. Or I always used to think, once I get a good job, once I get to be a success, this fear will go away. And of course, it doesn't. It intensifies because now there's more they're going to find out, it seems to you. They're going to unearth facts about you that you can't do the job you're doing, but you can't realize you're doing it. Because you wind up, I'm sure a lot of people in this room have done this. And that is this. I'm sure everyone in this room has done it. I would guess that sometimes when you really feel bad, you instinctively compare how you're feeling against how other people are looking. And you just wonder, why am I different? And I'll tell you. I'll tell you a little fact. Everyone does it sometimes when they're feeling bad. And the answer you get is always wrong. And the reason it's always wrong is because you're not aware I'm comparing my insides against their outsides. I'm comparing my raw meat against their defense mechanisms that they're built for 30 years. So I think it's safe to tell you that you will, when you're feeling bad, you will never see anyone who looks as sensitive as you feel. You will never see anyone who seems to feel different the way you do. You will never see anyone who seems to have the kind of loneliness in crowds that may bother you. And on and on. And instinctively comparing, you push yourself further and further away and never know it and think you're really trying to do something for yourself. Another great feeling I had much of my life, and intermittently now because these feelings don't disappear, had the feeling that when I was, a few years ago, I was really good at it though. I've always been able to see rejection where no one can see it. I can hear it in a tone of voice. I can see it in a glance. I can see it in a passing memo. And as a result of that, when you feel like that, you're always getting your feelings hurt. All it needs is a slightly demeaning tone of voice, and my feelings are hurt again. And when I get my feelings hurt, badly enough, I must take an action, which is the only action I know. I must punish that person by giving him the worst punishment I can think of. I deny them my presence. Okay. And I guess other people do that. But, you know, I've walked out on good jobs because somebody hurt my feelings. And I think later, why the hell did I do that? One time in Dallas, in a big job, in a big agency, and a guy was editing my copy. And I said, if it's going to be like that, for Christ's sake, get yourself another boy. And he said, okay. And later on, I thought, now, why did I say that? But that's what I know. I can't control my hurt feelings. And I have, over the years, I've tried to do a lot of things about it. When I was a young man, I did what seemed right to me. I went into psychoanalysis. Now, I guess there's still psychoanalysis, but I don't think it's anything like it used to be in the old days. Lately, there's been so many little people in it, it's gotten spoiled. But in my day, just the thinkers and the sensitive people were there. And you can joke if you want to, but I'll tell you, I made breakthroughs that would bring tears rolling down your cheeks. For example, I always loved the Norwich Lutheran Church. I may have let it down, but I loved it. And in psychoanalysis, I discovered years later that the Norwich Lutheran Church had psychologically scarred me, had ruined my emotional profile, had left me like Prometheus chained to a Nordic rock, for Christ's sake. I'll tell you, it put me in a terrible mood. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. We could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. I discovered I'd been hurt by the Depression. I discovered I'd been hurt by a lot of things. And I'll tell you, years later, I used to wonder, why did I love psychoanalysis? I could hardly wait to get there. It took all my money. I had to drive a long way. I drove to the next city. I didn't want people in my community to know that I was disturbed. I guess I preferred to have them think I had a brain tumor. And you never get any good news in psychoanalysis. You always find new things, how you've been screwed even more. I never understood why I liked it so well. But I have come to understand in the last 5 or 6 years, when I've seen other therapies grow up that provide the same service to a lot of people. And I'll tell you how they do it. And as psychoanalysis did for me. Whether they intend to do it that way, I don't know. Or whether psychoanalysis should have done it for me, I don't know. But it did it. Probably the worst single emotion I know that I've ever had in my life is guilt. I've had a lot of guilt. Guilt of things I have done. Guilt even more so of things I have not done. Of things I should have done, if only, on and on. And guilt is something, no matter what you say, you don't wash that away. You can't tap dance that away. That's why I was one of the reasons I like drinking. I'm thirsty. You ran out of milk for your coffee. What kind of meeting is this? Anyway. I'll tell you, when Bill and Dr. Bob and I met, we always had milk for the coffee. Shut off the tape, Earl. Anyway. But one thing that psychoanalysis had the ability to do, and alcohol is the only other thing I've ever had known what it had the ability to do it. To remove guilt. I never realized what it was doing, but in retrospect, I can see it removed guilt. And it freed me Now you say, how in the world can it remove guilt? There's a very simple thing, and it sounds almost too simple, but it is really true. And many people today are making millions of dollars on this theory. You get the patient to accept the role of perpetual victim. You have been victimized. You are a victim. They have done it to you. It is not your fault. And it sounds kind of funny, but it isn't funny. And it's a great thing. God, it's a great thing. Now you think, what's wrong with that? Why would anybody worry about that? Because of a little truism about life. Nothing is ever free in the world. Nothing good is ever free. Bad things are free many times. Good things are not free. You always got to pay something, but many times the price tag is not on top. It's buried underneath somewhere. And the price tag for victimization for people like me, and I presume a lot of people that I know who I've seen do it, you're not even aware of the price tag. There are three little price tags you must pay for people, personalities like mine. Whether you intend to or not, you must accept and enhance continuing resentment at those who have done it to you, especially if you're getting together with other people who have also victims, and you almost compete in your victimization without being aware of it. You don't even know it. You think you're in some kind of therapeutic. There's a continuing... Boy, you almost sat in my chair, newcomer. Well, now I've lost my place and I have to start over. My name is Clancy Emmisland and I'm an alpha. If you ever go to one of these therapies where their focus is on those who have done it to you, and I have a couple times, you will never see anyone in those meetings smiling, and you will never see anyone leaving the meeting smiling, because whether they intend to or not, they enhance resentment. Another feeling that comes as a result of this, the little price tag, whether you intend to or not, you must take on, without even being aware of it, the knowledge that you are permanently different. The example in my mind always was in my mind. It's as though I were a sapling tree, and forces beyond my control tipped me over, and I've become gnarled and crooked. And now I'm taking therapy to find out how it happened. But even if I find out how it happened, I'm always going to be a gnarled and crooked tree. And that's what's wrong with the feelings of difference. Yes, you can say all you want about returning to normal, all this nonsense. But my case truly is different, because these things happen to me. And the third little price tag you pay, which is quite obvious, if you think about it, there's intermittent but continuous self-pity. Because you just know, I could have been something. I had such potential. All I needed was love and some understanding, and I would have been something. But instead, they worked out their neurosis on me and ruined my life. Well, you might say this. Those are three unpleasant things, certainly, but maybe they're not too bad. You know, to get rid of guilt. Guilt is the big one. To do whatever you have to do to get rid of guilt. Accept these other feelings. And that may be okay for most people. But for people like me, as I turned out to be, and I presume like you if you're in this room, you find something strange. You read that blue book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and you will discover in there, for people like me, and I presume like you, it gives three specifics of emotions that are lethal for people like me. Resentment, self-pity, and feelings of difference. And why are they so lethal? How can they hurt you so bad? Because they will justify my drinking till I die from it. And as I die, I will say, not my fault. And that feeling of difference is the great killer of all people, I think. Like, we have such a great feeling of that anyway. It's, you know, as was mentioned, this year I've been in a lot of places in the world. You'd think it'd be a lot of exotic voices out there in Melbourne and Brisbane and Sydney and Cape Town and Durban and Johannesburg and London, all these places. Boy, I'm going to be really here. You might as well stay home. You hear the same crap, only in a different accent. That's really true. I don't know, I ever had my heart broken so much as I did about 5 years ago. I was 6 years ago now, I guess. I was in Berlin just after the wall came down. I collected bags of it, bricks. I'll sell them to you after the meeting. ignore the pennies signed on them. They're mine. But I sat in a the night before I had a talk, I talked to the day, and then the night before I sat in a little English-speaking meeting, and here for the first, we were in blocks of Checkpoint Charlie, where all the spies used to go back and forth. I'd gone through that day and came back and felt like the spy that came out of the cold or something, giving my impression of the left-handed Indian. And I, well, that's just something I threw, and I'll never do that again. Well, I try out my talks here to see how they play in the big convention. But, and you sit in the media and just know you're going to hear something about freedom and the dignity of mankind. And you hear some goof behind you.
But I'm afraid you don't really understand. I'm afraid my case is different.
See you down to the coffee shop, Hunt. And it's that way all over. Great feelings of difference, and whatever we do to enhance those feelings of difference really become lethal. Now, there's nothing, you know, it may sound as though I'm attacking therapies that preach these things. I am not. I have no feeling about them either as an AA member or as a human being. I have no feeling about these therapies. Sometimes people say, you're attacking these other therapies. I'm not. I wish them well. I hope their meetings tonight are full of people who are finding what they're looking for. But I've noticed in the last couple of years something that disturbs me a great deal. People are bringing these rather sodden therapies into Alcoholics Anonymous and expounding on them here. And I don't care what they do there, but when I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to hear a program of recovery dealing with Alcoholics Anonymous. I do not want to hear whose fault it is. Well, and that sounds bad, but I don't mean it bad. No more than I would go to their meeting and insist they practice the 12 traditions. It's two different things. Let them do their thing and we'll do our thing. And please, if you're new, please do not bring intermix these therapies and get into psychobabble into AA, because that's killed a lot of people and very nearly killed me, playing that psychobabble game till I died once, had to be brought back to life, and almost died again and never guessed what was wrong with me. But I got into psychoanalysis for years, and I read books, and I read German philosophy that I couldn't understand, know what the hell they're talking about. The only thing is, if other people are looking, you must say, how profound. How Deutsche Gesellschaft. I did a lot of things. But the one thing that helped me the most in all those years was a few drinks. I never found anything that would get me through emotional situations better than a few drinks. And I'll tell you, a few drinks is the best friend I got. In looking back, I can see what alcohol did for me. At the time, I just thought it made me feel better. But if I were to look at it clinically today, I would say what alcohol did for me without being aware of it. It takes a person like me who feels like they're never quite enough, and temporarily, I become more than enough. It takes a person like me who lives with a lot of fear, and temporarily, I'm fearless. It takes a person like me who lives with rejection and turns me briefly into the rejecter. Which doesn't sound like much, but that is a biggie. The best example of that, I've used it 1,001 times now, but I don't know a better way to put it. I'm sure a lot of you young guys have had this experience. Sit in a bar late at night, have a few drinks, watching the miracle of alcohol take place in front of your eyes. Watching some old beast slowly become beautiful. I might sidle over to such an old queen at closing time. Imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension if she'd like to join me in the old Chevy. Now, she would say, now! I don't feel rejected. I would if I didn't have any drinks. But when I have a few drinks, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Don't come begging tomorrow, bitch. That is something great to have all the way through. I was a better father, a better worker, a better at everything. I could make small talk. I was working in a public relations guy, and I couldn't make small talk sober. That's hard for a public relations guy. Well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow. Maybe get your courage up. See the woman over there in the gray dress? Looks like an elephant, huh? Oh, that's your wife. Going to be a scorcher tomorrow. When I have a few drinks, baby, I move to that Algonquin round table in about 3 minutes. And I'm too hip for the room. I'm just... Drinking is the best thing I've ever... The only problem I've ever had. Alcohol is the best friend I got. I have an unfortunate tendency sometimes to drink a little too much. Or as I like to believe, many times I have been thoughtlessly overserved. And when I drink too much, I sometimes act a little bizarre. And I never understood that until I got into psychoanalysis and realized that I'd been chained all my life and it temporarily broke my bonds. I became free for a moment. And I like that. I never could get a cop to buy that, but I bought it. I've been chained into a rock, and I've been... Oh, shut up, get in the car, you asshole. You know. So I was kind of well-known in that small college town, so I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. And it was a nice place, but it wasn't a place for me. It's a place for people whose problem is alcohol. That was very clear to me from after my third meeting. I went to AA off and on for years, but I always knew AA can't help me. There's a dreadful reversal here. I wish it weren't correct. I wish it weren't true. I'm not hiding behind it. I hate it. But I am not an alcoholic. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. And as a result, they have difficulties with their life. And I look exactly the same, but it's not at all. I have a problem with life. And as a result of that, I have difficulties with alcohol. And the major difference is they get sober and clean up their act, and their life gets better. I get sober and clean up my act, and the horrors come back. The fear, the loneliness, the despair, the feelings of difference. And pretty soon you can read all the philosophy you want, or you can find all the reasons for it. An old analogy I used to use, and it's kind of true, is that I spent much of my adult life trying to find out why I have these emotions. I'm sure people in this room are doing the same thing. I've spent thousands of dollars and years to do that, and I want to give you some hope if you're doing that. You can find out what causes these emotions in various therapies. The bad part is it doesn't help. You wind up feeling crappy and knowing why. The only reason I've ever thought of you might even use that information some night in a bar, some guy come over and say, "Hey, what the hell's wrong with you?" "Well, let me tell you, I was born in the Lutheran church." Shut up, you know. And I went up and down and I drank and I went, sometimes I got a little troubled. I went to different places, got different therapies. I kept having children, so I had to get better jobs. And I had ups and downs, became quite successful one time. And it got a little worse, and my feelings were worse, and people were acting funny, and the years went by, and it's just... And the day came in my life that cannot come to people with my background and intelligence and experience, I'll guarantee you. The day came when I found myself being thrown out of the midnight mission on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And the guy said, "And stay out of here, you bum." And I tried to explain to him, "I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write for the Borden Company that were running out very weak. But Elsie and Elmer, remember those old cows? And Life and Time and Collier's and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement." How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. You know, And unfortunately, I'd had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix jail about 3 weeks before that, so I wasn't hitting those consonants quite as cleanly as I would have liked. And I stood outside of that Skid Row mission. If a guy had come up to me and said, "Slim, you're dying. You an alcoholic?" I'd have had to say, "No, I'm not, but I wish I was. I wish I was. I wish I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what they did to me, but there's no way out. I've lost my wife. I'll never see my children again, my parents. I'm an only child, and my parents have ripped me off. It just killed them to do it. But they couldn't stand the pain anymore. I couldn't think of anyone who would accept a collect phone call from me. I'm sure there were people who would. But I didn't know who they were. And it started to rain a little bit. And the way it was raining Friday night here in Washington, it was kind of a slow drizzle. And I walked 71 blocks out to an AA club in the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax that I'd been asked to leave a week before for being in there drunk and causing trouble. And I had not the slightest idea, intention, or aim of ever staying sober. Because staying sober to me is death. The only time I ever made any sobriety at all was when I was in Texas. We'd had a son die when I was in jail overnight, which was just ate me up. I know it wasn't the cause of his death, but it seemed to me it was. If I'd have been there, it wouldn't have happened, I kept thinking. It would have happened. But I took a little vow in his casket that I would never drink. Again, when my wife was in the midst of having a baby, you're having a small baby, and she was pregnant, and I stayed sober. I was staging a grand opera at the University of Texas. That was my nighttime job. In the daytime, I was writing advertising, and I was writing a weekly sports column for a paper, and these kids were there, and it was very hot. And I loved these kids, but God, they were noisy and loud, and sun, and Texas, and I just went, I couldn't drink. God, I remember thinking, I couldn't drink. And one day, they went to church, and I pulled the car in the garage, and hooked up a hose, and turned the motor, and went to sleep and died. I could not think of a way out. And a neighbor saw me, and he brought me out, just recently dead, I guess, and they beat on my chest, and went me to the hospital, and to the psych ward, and I wound up being committed to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period as a paranoid schizophrenic. Now, when you're working very hard to get your life together and you want to be something, you have an intuitive feeling this is going to look bad on your resume. I finally got out, but it wasn't easy. I had to pretend to be an alcoholic the next year. And then I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. I was saying this the other night too. I must go back to Texas and find that psychiatrist. He's very old now, I'm sure, and feeble. I could move him around pretty easily. Hey, you quack! You ought to lose your license, for Christ's sake, diagnosing me as a dual personality. What a crazy diagnosis. If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it. You know. My problem has always been this committee that forms at the drop of a hat. What do you think we ought to do? I'm not sure. What do you think? I don't know. That's right. Yeah. I used to hear people years ago say, "I'm not sure AA's enough for me. I may have to go to group therapy." I think, boy, I feel sorry for you. All I have to do is go for a ride alone in my car. That's right, huh? That's one of the reasons I like alcohol. It gets it down to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. Why don't you quit your job and punch him in the face? Okay. And I like to be with other people who have the same feelings. Late at night when I'm in a bar, somebody says, "Hey, let's go to Juarez." I want to hear a bunch of people say, "Yeah!" I don't want to be a bunch of wimps who say, "Why?" Because there's technicolor there. Drinking does something. What good is it going to be to walk 71 blocks to an AA club where there's a bunch of crazed AA fanatics? AAs are bad enough, but AA fanatics move to a new dimension. For any problem you got, they think the solution is, "We'll go to a lot of meetings, get a sponsor, it'll all work out." And they want you to go sit in those meetings where those old crap heads.
Friends, I stayed drunk around the clock 29 years. One day I walked through that door, and the desire left to drink left me instantly like a cloak fluttering to the floor. I now have $3 million with me tonight. Several different families have returned to me. And I owe it all to one thing. I put the plug in the jug.
And if you're new and despondent, you know, that is not a hopeful... You remember thinking, I wish I had one curare dart. Just one, just... Tell us how that feels, you old sumbitch. You know... You know, I think a lot of times newcomers, at least when I was new, I got through, I just kind of hated speaker meetings. I liked the first part when they were talking about how bad it was. But when it got to the good part, you just feel, well, I think newcomers would listen a lot better if every so often we had a speaker come in and say,
and then it turned out, God damn it, I just couldn't make it.
At least it'll give you some interest to guess.
He will.
I fell into the hands of an evil sponsor because they always wanted to get a sponsor. I got an actor who I'd seen playing loving roles in the movies, and it turned out these were top performances because he had no love in his body. He was a dictator and a... He didn't share, he told you. I used to lie awake and I'd think about that puke and just... I'll tell you, there were two or three times in my first year of sobriety, this sounds funny, but it's true, I very much remember thinking, if I only had enough money, they always tell me I didn't have any money, I would like to call the World Service Office in New York and turn this son of a bitch in. Just... I just want you to know there's an old-timer in Los Angeles killing newcomers. And I'll give you his name and address. And now it's 35 years later. Things are a lot different. When I talk to the World Service Office in New York, I say, no, I'm not. I've been on both sides of this equation. I've laid awake and thought about a sponsor all night. And I have slept while others have lain awake and thought about me. I prefer this side of it, if it's okay with you. But I eventually did something. I don't know how else to say it. I said this again the other night. Whatever I had going for me, at least I had one thing. I had not sold out. I always took pride in that. I'm not a phony. If I don't believe in something, I don't believe in it. I'm not going to say I do. I'm not going to be a phony. I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I've been down and I've been up. But by God, I got some intellectual integrity. And if I lose that, it's all over. And over a period of time, it was so bad, I had little jobs in a law school. I was living in the back seat in the abandoned car back at the A Club many nights. Slept on a guy's sofa. And he's crazed for that. No front seat. And I found myself little by little, just to get the heat off me, selling out pieces of my intellectual integrity. It just, I'll tell you, it made me feel terrible. I found myself, because someone told me to, going over and shaking hands with someone who I detested. Hello. And think to myself, I'd like to rip off your goddamn arm, smash you over the head. Going up to speakers and thanking them for their talk. Thank you. And thinking, you're almost as big a hypocrite as my sponsor. Picking up cups. Pick up that cup. Okay, Bob. And thinking, you know why you don't get in parks and movies anymore? Because you're over the edge. I remember lying awake and I think, what is happening to me? I'm selling out. I'm doing things that I'm not getting any better. I'm just selling out. And I had no idea then or sometime thereafter. I look back now, that's when my recovery started. Who would have ever thought that?
Who'd have ever guessed that the concept, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, begins with superimposing direction over my instincts? It says that after you hear a while, you read that silly book, and it has said it all along. But who would know that? You almost have to get weller for a while to understand the book is referring to you. You have to unlearn a lot of things. People like me, there may be a few people here. It isn't learning the things, but it's unlearning the things you already know that are false. And you don't move them out of your door in time, because your door only opens from the inside. And sometimes that misinformation keeps you from ever opening and you die from it. You know, we talk a lot about recovery and we see a lot of sober people. But in America last year, it was estimated 95% of alcoholics die drunk. The ones who died last year were died drunk. Or is it a direct result of drinking? Because it is a program of denial. Denial. And everyone in this room knows that. We know down deep that my case truly is different. And I took these actions and I survived more for them. It was other actions. And I eventually, the suicidal frenzy one day, he focused my pain. I would say, if you're kind of new, you may wonder what a sponsor does. Well, think of it this way. Begin to understand the concept to begin with. It is true, alcohol is not your problem. Who would have guessed that? I thought that was the right thought I had. It turns out if alcohol were the problem, there'd be no need for AA. We'd all go to a detox and we'd be well. Alcohol is not the problem. The problem is something called alcoholism. It sounds like the same, but there's a big difference. And a lot of differences, but for a short, Jesus, let's put, an alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. You will discover in this strange, denigrating, destructive, emotionally eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you cannot stand it. But even that doesn't make an alcoholic. In addition to that, you must be one of the 5 or 6 or 7% of people who are born in every generation, and nobody knows why, who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And never know it's an unnatural reaction because you have nothing to measure it against. What is it? You stay drunk all the time?
Nah.
Makes you act crazy? Some people do, some don't. I see alcoholics die on a regular basis. Some of them never acted crazy once. Is it can't handle it? Nope. It is something so common that I would never have guessed it in 10,000 years. Alcohol must have the unnatural effect to almost instantly make everything all right. Now, who would think that's unnatural? Can you imagine? It doesn't do that for most people. That's why they don't drink. It has to have whatever we call it, making the world technicolor, getting that boom, feeling like something. But it's an unnatural reaction. If you have it, it's a great feeling. But the problem is, eventually you become dependent on it. It sometimes didn't, you know, sometimes you can drink for years before you get that feeling. That's why the book talks about, in some cases, they cross an invisible line without knowing it. They start to become emotionally dependent on alcohol without knowing it. And some people have that feeling when they first drink, when they're new. That's why we have that unusual thing in AA sometimes. Find old timers, get up and talk and scowl at little snots like Kathleen over there.
I stayed drunk for 35 years.
And they don't say anything, but they look as if to say, I drank longer than you've been alive, you little snot. What do you know about alcohol? And what they don't know is the little snot is sitting there thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 35 years, you old son of a bitch. Yeah. It turns out it isn't how long you drink, it's when it begins to go boom. Then you start to become a little dependent on it. Then you start to have a little trouble with it, as you must. Then you stay sober. And there you face these emotions you're running away from. So eventually you got to drink. But eventually you got to get sober. Then you got to drink. Then you got to get sober. That phenomenon is called alcoholism. And nearly everyone who has it has the feeling, I'm not really an alcoholic because my problems are worse when I'm sober. And it is an alcohol. You could, that's why it's alcohol. Now, what's this got to do with sponsorship? I'll tell you this. I travel around a lot. And in AA, most of you heard me say this. There are pockets of enthusiasm around the world. That's a great pocket of enthusiasm in Omaha, that's the Foxball group. There's pockets here and pockets there with areas of blah in between where people are just staying sober mostly. And anytime you find a strong pocket of enthusiasm, you will find a strong sponsorship effort. And the reason that is because strong sponsorship gets you into taking actions that you would never do if you're left to your own decisions on what to take. That's what brings about enthusiasm. I love that word enthusiasm. You know, it comes from a Greek root that really is appropriate for us. It's from en within, theos, God. It means the expression of the God within. Enthusiasm. And that's really what it is if you're lucky enough to have it from time to time. What about this sponsorship, about pain? You know, I do a lot of flying. A lot of you people in the room fly. And kind of, you look out the window, that old jet is pushing you at 560 miles an hour, and you're sitting there. And then it lands, like at Nashville. You don't have much room to stop, and that plane's got very bad brakes. Okay. Oh, mercy. Maybe we'll hit that bridge like the other guy did. But what they do, they stop the plane by reversing the thrust of the jets. The same thrust stops the plane, only going a different direction. And in a real sense, to me, that's what sponsors do, if you can allow them to do it. They take the pain that guarantees you must drink, and if you are left them, they will change the thrust and have you take actions that will enable you not to have to drink again. And it really boils down to it. But every fiber of my being says, I know he means well, but he can't possibly know as much about my problems as I do. I know he would like to help me, but goddammit, his answers are simplistic. You know, go to a meeting rather than worry about my rent? That's goofy. And yet if you can surrender, that's they talk about surrender. What are you surrendering? You are surrendering your will. You know, I should surrender that to God. People like you and me, when we're under duress, can't really trust God. God is good, but my receiver gets mixed up sometimes. You know, sometimes God tells people to have a drink. And the receiver missed the word not in there. You better have somebody who interprets God's will for you right here. God seems to speak to people, especially when you're disturbed. You got to go somewhere and say, what do you do? And they tell you, and it's ridiculous! And you go do it. And later on, you take credit for it. Yeah. The day I was going to commit suicide, I was on my way to where I was going to commit suicide. Because I'd taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why should I take it with a well-meaning blabbermouth actor? And he cursed me. He steered that pain and he had me write the inventory. And within a week, I was at meetings talking to newer people saying, I don't know how you expect to stay around here if you're not willing to write an inventory the way we've done. Except I must admit I didn't have any front teeth. I had a gummit. But that's what it's about. But talk about denial. I want to close. I know a lot of you got several blocks to go to get home. Here's an interesting thing. Over the years, I've had three people that I sponsor die of cancer, long, slow deaths. A lot of people get better from cancer with modern methods. These people happen to be people who let it go and didn't check it. They're dying from it. And I said, they all died in UCLA, because that's a great cancer hospital. And they do have a part of the ward that's kind of people in recovery, but there's kind of a hospice end to where they die. And I felt it was my job as a sponsor to sit there. God, I hate it, but I'm glad I did it. But I remember sitting there thinking one night, God, you know, looking at these people dying and thinking, what would they say? What if I was able to get up and say, hey, got a deal for you. Would you folks be willing to spend an hour or two every day going somewhere with a bunch of people, drinking some coffee, having a few laughs, talking over how you can feel better, seeing old friends? Would you do that if I could cure your cancer? They would offer you their homes, their cars, everything. I got taken. Oh, my God, take me. Everything, please. The worst place I've ever been in my life was in the Los Angeles County, last year, Los Angeles County Charity Wards for AIDS. Not only people dying of AIDS, but they're thrown away. Nobody gives a damn about them anymore. And they lay there in various states of incoherent. Sick and open sores. And the smell is unbelievable. What do you think those people said? Hey! Would any of you be willing to take a series of maybe 12 actions that don't seem to have any application to what you're doing here? And even talk about things that you never told anybody? If I could clear up your AIDS, they would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. I'll guarantee you. But in that same hospital, you go to the charity alcoholic ward where they're dying from alcoholism. They say, come on, we're going to have a meeting. Guy laying on the bed with his liver out to here, eyeballs yellow, dying. I'll get that AA shit out of here. I'm not an alcoholic. And it's kind of funny. Except you come back next month, and he's dead, and there's a new guy in the hospital saying the same thing. Now, if people who are dying from active alcoholism can prove they're not an alcoholic, you and I sure as heck can. And that's why it's incumbent upon us, as our chairman said tonight, to go to these meetings and listen for the differences, because your mind will magnify, or listen to the similarities, because your mind will magnify the differences. And your mind can prove you don't belong here. And your mind can prove you need the relief that a drink can bring. But you got to remember, if you didn't have a trouble with it, it wouldn't bring that relief. It's a funny paradox. If you really want a drink, you can't have one. Well, we're a bunch of losers, that's all. I was thinking about it tonight. You got the white building here. Look at that wall back there. 4 trophies. Everybody finished second. Not one winner. Christ's sake. I identify. And it's only a 2-team league. But gradually over a period of time, what alcoholism does, it little by little, I want to say this and I'll stop. You may wonder what AA is about. I have a young lady in the front row that knew, and I'm trying to explain a little bit to her. The rest of you all know this, I'm sure. What does AA do? You can only get so sober. Now what? AA is designed, I believe, based on my experience, much to my surprise, to very slowly do what alcohol does fast. To little by little take a person like me, who has always felt not good enough, and most of the time today I feel good enough. Not all the time, because I've learned that no human being feels good enough all the time. That's part of being a human being. That's not an alcoholic self-pity device. A person like me who's lived with fear most of my life, I go down alleys in Skid Row today. I should tell you, I stayed sober a while and got successful getting advertising. And one day in a fit of inanity, I left a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 20 years I run the midnight mission on Skid Row, the place that threw me out in 1958. But I go down to Skid Row, I go down alleys on Skid Row where the police are afraid to go with drawn guns. And I'm down there smiling. But I'm still a human being. At home, when there's a suspicious noise in the backyard, I send my wife out to see what it is. It could be a booger man. I don't feel hardly rejected much. I do sometimes. I don't get my feelings hurt a lot. I do sometimes. I'm a human being. That's part of living. That's what it's about. Probably the best way I know to sum it up. When I was first in that Texas nut house, and they put me on shock treatments, I ran away. They thought that indicated restlessness. It indicated good sense to me. And they brought me back. They gave me shock treatments. Then they had me direct a Christmas pageant where the main thrust of the director was trying to hold the 3 wise men off the Virgin Mary. We just want to worship her, Clancy. And then I'd been in AA, in and out of AA for 6 or 7 years by that time. So I was able to pretend to be an alcoholic, tell them what they wanted to hear. And I eventually got transferred to the Texas State Nut House, Big Spring Hospital, first alcoholic ward. And I'd never been in any alcoholic meetings in Texas. I don't know if you've ever been to Texas. But they do differ down there. It really is grotesque. I guess it's all right. But if you're just off shock treatment, it loses a little something. Nothing personal, Ed. Hey, I came in this ward, went to a meeting. Now, you and I would get up and say, my name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. But not in Texas, not in West Texas. My name is Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or medication. It's my sobriety day. And for this, I'm truly grateful. Then they say, oh, Fred. Send me back to Ward 9. And I've always thought, if I ever got the position of prominence, even though I'm not an alcoholic, but if I did, I'd go to those AA meetings, and I'd at least give them the breaks of telling them the truth, not some rigmarole recitation of some cliched stuff. Maybe not those exact words. So I'm very glad I'm back at Fox Hall tonight because I wanted to tell you what I found in AA. I found, as you heard me say, I found out what an alcoholic was, so I said I was an alcoholic. If I could really tell you the truth of what you get out of AA, you remember this, kid. My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. And here's what else I've learned. I've learned that through the grace of God and the power of this simple program, it has not been necessary for me to drink any alcohol or take any mind-sedating or tranquilizing medications since October the 31st, 1958. And for this, I am truly grateful. Bye.
Thank you very much, Clancy. I will only just make a little quick comment, and that is the next time you're on the East Coast, please come back. Tapes are available up here from Earl. We ask that you please help put away at least all the good brown chairs underneath the stage. These things roll out. And pick up your coffee cups and help clean up the establishment. If we can, let's close in the usual manner.